Broadsheet Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode and another season of your favorite history podcast. It fucking better be Shared History.
Leave the history to us.
Do it. We can't guarantee that it'll be in good hands, but we'll do our best.
We'll send it your way.
We sure will. We'll share it.
We'll always share. We've shared everything with you, and we've done it for the past six seasons.
Yeah, this is episode one, season seven, aka episode 97. Getting close to that big hundo, Kat.
Oh man, episode 69 got wild. I can't imagine what we're gonna do for 100.
The amount of times somebody will be like, oh, what episode do you recommend? Or I'll be like, oh, well, if you want to hear about the history of sex toys, I'm like, we have to do an episode on that. And they're like, what's the episode number? I always like slow-mo smirk and just very, very pleased with myself go, episode 69.
I'm going to let you guess what episode you think it is.
Sometimes I say it like, fucking duh, you idiot. I'm like, episode episode 69.
Our finale with dear friend and love of our lives, Alex DiVergilio, we had a little bit of a back and forth of like just some really inappropriate innuendos, which did rival that of episode 69.
That's true.
I know. I would never have thought.
I know. We're very appropriate all the time.
But we're on season seven. This is wild. We've got more history for you. It's even history-ier. Mm-hmm. And it's the same old Nat and Cass.
Same old Nat and Cass. I'm going to kick us off this season. We're just going to get right into it. We're going to hop into that history machine. When are we? 1919, a year you might see me return to.
Wait, can I guess where?
Where are we?
Are we in Chicago?
Yeah, we're in Chicago.
Oh yes, are we doing all Chicago season?
Listen, Cass,
for Nat,
permission/a challenge to do an entire season of Chicago history. So here we fucking go.
Let's do this.
We're gonna regret this so hard.
Here's the thing. I give you shit about Chicago all the time just because, like, the more Chicago history you tell me, the more I'm like, is there any more? I feel like I've heard all of it. So it's like, but is it a challenge? Because I don't think it's a challenge for you to come up with more Chicago history. So it's kind of just I just want to see it happen.
There are several stories that have been sitting on my list for a while that I haven't done, because whenever we spend a lot of time in America or in North America with our history, I'll then be like, I want to get out of here. And unfortunately, that often means that I keep pushing some of these Chicago stories onto the back burner. So I'm very excited for this.
Can't wait. I'm so stoked.
Here we fucking go. I'm starting off with a bang, literally, because if there is one thing Chicago's history seems to be known for, it's terrible violence and disaster. I promise I won't only cover horrible, horrible disasters on this season, but that's where I'm starting. Cass, you probably won't love this.
Is there fire involved?
There's fire.
Fucking shit.
Okay. Are you familiar, just to really level set where we're going to spend this episode, are you familiar with the Hindenburg disaster?
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah, I'm familiar. Big ol' explosion.
Okay, so if you weren't, 1937, the Hindenburg Zeppelin, it go boom, okay?
Go big boom.
Go big boom. Not to brag, that was 1937. Chicago did it like two decades earlier. Because if we're over
Chicago, Chicago Hindenburg before Hindenburg?
Yeah, we Hindenburged before Hindenburg.
Oh, shit. Can I tell you my very first comedy sports show? I was guessing for five things, and the Hindenburg was one of them. And they kept they kept saying, like, giving me, like, Led Zeppelin as a clue. And then Bruce was like, Scabba da Gigada! Like, oh, the humanity!
Oh, no.
And I didn't get it. I didn't get it. But I did get the Moody Blues. Anyway, continue.
Well, since it happened about 20 years before, maybe we shouldn't refer to things as like Hindenburging. We should refer to them as Wingfoot Air Expressing.
What?
Let me take you to July 21st, 1919. And let me introduce you to a little aircraft called the Wingfoot Air Express. It was a dirigible, which is a non-rigid airship, aka a blimp. And it was being used to transport people from Grant Park to the White City Amusement Park, the Chicago World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition, which we know started in 1893. But like, it's still hanging around. Bits of it are still hanging around. People are still having a good old time. Chicago World's Fair is like, we know, we talked about this in our finale episode with for season five with, was that one? No, season four with Jim Vizella. Hooray innovation. Lots of firsts at the Chicago World's Fair.
Woo-hoo.
Lots of firsts. Goodyear's goal was to promote what they saw as the future of passenger air travel, and they saw that as blimps. So the Wingfoot Air Express was owned by the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. When the Columbia Exposition first opened in 1893, there's lots of firsts, but by 1919, the skies are still like a foreign frontier for most Americans. Like, Kitty Hawk's already happened, but for
most— What's Kitty Hawk?
The first flight. The Wright brothers flew in Kitty Hawk.
Oh, I didn't know what that was.
So the Wright brothers have already taken their first flight, but like, by and large, the average American cannot take to the skies. So whereas now, Goodyear blimps over a like baseball field or a football game are kind of standard or a tradition, the Wingfoot would have been the first blimp to ever pass over a ball game when it made its first long voyage of that day. It would have gone right over Comiskey, where the White Sox play, had it made it that far. Instead, it became a different first for America. It became the first civil aviation disaster.
Oh no.
Yay. The blimp was assembled at the White City Aerodrome in just like the weeks leading up to its premiere flights on July 21st, 1919. The morning of the 21st, it's taken for a spin. It goes on a few short flights, kind of just taking a test spin around Grant Park, which if you aren't familiar with Chicago, is a large park. On the lakefront, it is a fairly large park. There used to be a airstrip over there called the Grant Park Airstrip. That's where it was landing. So it's basically like taking off and landing from there, doing a little loop, and thousands gathered to like see the Wingfoot close up at each landing at the airstrip. Those short flights had the pilot, a handful of mechanics, government officials, and reporters on it just being like, oh, good show, sir. Oh, good flight. Look at us. We're in the sky in a balloon. But at 4:50, they were scheduled to take the final takeoff of the day and their first long flight, the first voyage of what the blimp was going to be used for, which was transporting people from Grant Park to the White City Amusement Park, which is down on in the Woodlawn neighborhood on 63rd Street. So that was what the plan was. 450. So 450, July 21st, 1919, the Wingfoot takes off from Grant Park. It's headed south. There are five people on board. Newspaper photographer E.H. Horton, the pilot, Jack Botner, chief mechanic Harry Wacker, another mechanic, Henry Weaver, and a publicity agent for the amusement park, Earl W. Davenport. Just after takeoff, Captain Botner steered the Wingfoot over Chicago, the downtown Chicago Loop District, to give Horton, our photographer, the opportunity to take some breathtaking photos of the city skyscrapers from above. Because when have we had the opportunity? 5 minutes later, at 4:55, the blimp is 1,200 feet above the city. Captain Botner felt, quote, a terrible tremor in the fuselage, a shudder of the steer cables that held the gondola suspended beneath the blimp. The airship had caught fire and began closing in on itself, because hydrogen, as it rapidly descended towards the city below, because they were flying it above the city. Passengers and crew make for the parachutes. Earl W. Davenport's parachute got tangled in the cables of the airship, and so he was left kind of tethered, hanging below the blimp, but like stuck to the blimp. And so when the birding craft crashed, goodbye, Earl W. Davenport. He would have died on impact. Botner and chief mechanic Harry Wacker parachute to safety. E.H. Horton made it out in his parachute, but just wasn't. He's a photographer. He's not parachuted before. So he broke both of his legs upon landing on the ground, and then later died from his injuries in the hospital. And then Henry Weaver, the other mechanic, his parachute caught on fire and he crashed into the distinctive skylight of a building below. They were right above the financial district. So he crashed through the skylight of the Illinois Trust and Savings Bank, which is a beautiful structure that is designed by the same architect, Burnham, who was responsible for a lot of the buildings of the World's Fair. His body fell through the glass and into the bank below. The ship itself was not far behind him. Cass looks so stressed. I said you weren't
gonna. I'm not making any rules right here. Like, you can do as much Chicago as you want. Can we limit the fire in the future?
Yeah. I apologize.
Actually, fuck it. You know what? It's one of those things where I hate and it scares the shit out of me, but like, I want to keep hearing about it.
Yeah, this doesn't get better. So Henry Weaver's body skylight. The ship itself kind of falls behind him, hits the skylight. It is like collapsing into sheets of fire, falling onto the glass roof of the bank, which it's a glass roof. So now there's glass everywhere. A bank that, let's take solace in the fact that it is 4:55. So the bank was closed for patrons, but there's still hundreds of people who are working at this bank. So these people who are at work had no warning who would expect a fiery blimp disaster to fall and crash through your beautiful atrium-like ceiling. They would have had no warning other than like a shadow passing over the marble rotunda, a crash, and Henry's body crashing to the bank floor. Witnesses described it as, quote, fire raining down from the roof and an avalanche of shattered window panes and twisted iron. falling and cascading on everyone inside the bank. The fuselage of the blimp, which had two heavy rotary engines and two gasoline tanks, crashed into the floor, the tanks exploding instantly and therefore like spreading gasoline fire around them. Panic ensues. People have caught fire from the fire that it is raining down upon them. And there's, of course, because we're just going to keep having this issue, there's only like two fucking exits for some fucking reason. Because, of course.
Yeah.
When all was said and done, all but the pilot and the chief mechanic from the passengers aboard the Wingfoot, they all did not make it. And shockingly, only 10 bank employees were killed. 27 were injured. The intense heat of the disaster made rescue work really difficult. For about 30 minutes, they couldn't really go in and get anyone out from the wreckage who hadn't been able to make it out on their own. It was nearly an hour before they could finally, they were able to quench the flames on the roof from the flaming gas bag that caught the roof on fire as it crashed through it. And of course, because it's like watching a train crash, a crowd of 20,000 people watched all the rescue work from like the streets, and they were watching from the buildings nearby. The cause of the fire was is ultimately still unknown. There's a bunch of theories. One of them is that there's a spark thrown from the rotary motors. There was a lot of discussion about whether or not it's actually would have been safe for them to have that kind of motor near hydrogen. Mm-hmm. Another theory is like the sun.
Tell me more about the sun.
Like that the sun, I'm not a scientist. The theory is like that the sun somehow like expanded and like overcharged the blimp and like the gas inside it, and then it went kaboom. A third theory is that the gas bag had been smoldering since the dirigible even left Grant Park. Witnesses said that there is a mechanic had been applying a blowtorch to the propellers just before they took off because he was trying to burn off the oil from the propeller's bearings. And so there's like a chance that like he had set into motion the fire.
Catastrophe. There,
there's what's fun.
Tell me, Natalie, tell me what's fun about this.
What's fun is that according to a New York Times article or report from like the day of the disaster, the ship was said to have been filled with hydrogen, which at the time, according to this report, was apparently not thought to be flammable. So they thought that part of the issue was that like while charging for the flight or whatever, some oxygen may have gotten in the blimp or in like the gas tanks or something. And oxygen, they're like, oxygen bad, hydrogen great. Like, the problem here was definitely the oxygen. Not a scientist.
Yeah. Oh, God.
The extent of the damage to the bank, obviously, structurally, big damage. But, like, the fact that it's a bank, like, and it's records and whatnot, they don't actually know how much damage was done that way. It was declared by an official, like, a bank official that $50,000 in government bonds was lost to the fire, old for conversion, which would have been equivalent to about $857,000 today. $857,000, almost $858,000 today. That just in like, we burned up a whole bunch of government bonds because everything was on fire.
Yeah.
As a result, the city adopted a new set of rules for aviation over the city. There's a whole bunch of not very interesting history about that that I could go into. I will.
Please don't.
I won't.
Stick with the fire.
Another thing that they changed is very shortly after that, the Grant Park airstrip was also closed. I think those two are connected because, like, they were like, you wouldn't be taking off from here and not. You basically, like, it was too close to the city, so you couldn't really fly over the city anymore or whatnot. Everybody really thought blimps were going to be a thing. Like, so we thought, like, airships were going to be a thing.
They're just so goofy looking.
They're so silly. But they are, like, I believe from a resource perspective, they are considered a very efficient, not time efficient, but like a very resource and like efficient method of travel. I am pulling that information from the fact that airships are very popular in near future science fiction.
Yeah. So do you think the downfall of blimps, other than the fact that it's a stupid name, blimp,
right? Dirigible, airships, not much better.
Dirigible. That makes me, isn't that something from Alice in Wonderland?
Probably.
Don't step on the dirigible. Oh, no. Oh, it's from Harry Potter. It's Xenophilius's Lovegood has like a garden. It's like, don't step on the dirigible, whatever. Anyway, doesn't matter. Do we think that maybe blimps could have made it if we hadn't had two such huge fuck ups?
I definitely think that. Look, I definitely think
look.
Wingfoot and the Hindenburg gave blimps a bad name.
Also, Wingfoot was going to be the name of Padfoot in Harry Potter, but they didn't want to associate themselves with that catastrophe.
Yeah, they were like,
that
no,
no one knows about.
We don't want to. It's, yeah, I think the real mistake here was filling anything with hydrogen and then it also requiring like an open flame or intense heat or fire.
I mean, there's that, but that's, I don't know. That's up for debate. Like, I think,
I guess I'm thinking this is
the hydrogen and fire are bad.
Every time I see, like, I was, if you watch like His Dark Materials, they travel by like airship. And I'm always like, that looks like such a fun, silly way to travel.
It does. Also,
trust it.
Have you been watching His Dark Materials?
Is the new season out? I haven't been watching it.
No, because I haven't watched any of it because I didn't. They like sneaky came back, and so I
you
need to watch.
Haven't been watching
that.
Any of it?
None's of it.
Our Lord and Savior Andrew Scott's in it.
I know.
Get to it, young lady.
I need to. Also, and you may have already answered this, but I blacked out during all of the fire and catastrophe.
It was a trauma response. It's fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I was just going back to our episode with Mo when you were talking about
your Koi Theater fire.
Yep. Took the words right out of my mouth. Why did the Hindenburg get all of the fame to claim?
Bigger. Bigger ship, bigger boom, bigger disaster.
Bigger is always better.
Do a big boom.
Did this one, I mean, how many people, what's the death toll difference between the Wingfoot and the Hindenburg? And please convert for our European friends as well. The number
convert,
of deaths.
Sorry, convert the casualties?
Yeah. Does it work that way?
Not that much. The Hindenburg was there's only 35 deaths in the Hindenburg, and there were what 12 13 for Wingfoot.
Wasn't there a lot of like press included in the Hindenburg though?
So here
I really don't know much about it except okay. Big old blimp went boom and it was in a movie and it's famous and it's kind of like a punchline for a lot of things.
I am pretty sure that the Hindenburg, because I know that the Hindenburg was a passenger airship, which technically the Wingfoot was too, but it was a much smaller ship with less people on it when it went down, whereas like the Hindenburg was a commercial passenger carrying ship.
Yeah.
So maybe that's, I don't know, and honestly, I don't know enough about the Hindenburg, but a big part of it also is that the Hindenburg, we have just actual footage of that on the newsreel. So I think
maybe
it is
that's
also
what
like
it is, yeah.
That we have, there's photos of Wingfoot. There are photos of 1919.
Yeah.
We have photos of the Wingfoot disaster, but we have like, they were filming it anyway for the Hindenburg. So
I'm always curious, like, what makes one thing get famous as opposed to the other when it's the same thing? And in this case, it's just press exposure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Natalie. And I'm going to cut you off right there because I don't want to talk about it anymore. But
I was going to do a book recommendation because.
Oh, do. Yes. His Dark Materials, Philip Pullman.
That's my toxic trait. The reason I said that there's a chance I'll talk about 1919 a lot is for many reasons. Just that is a very critical year in Chicago in American history, especially in like race history, because it was 1919. There were in Chicago, there were race riots that summer. But there's a really great book. So July of 1919 is known as the Red July. This is partially because of the race riots that began that month, that summer. But there's this book that I would highly recommend if you're interested in Chicago history, or if you just like
race riots.
No.
Okay. I was like, where are you going there?
if you like nonfiction, this is a particularly, even if you're like, man, I don't really read history, like this book reads phenomenally. And also the audiobook is really good. I listened to this on a road trip. The book's called City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago. And it is by Gary Crist, K-R-I-S-T.
Good title.
Mm-hmm. And he says the 12 days because he literally focuses on less than 12 weeks in the middle of July. And those 12 days kick off like so much chaos. And the Wingfoot Air Express disaster is like the inciting incident basically of these, of these 12 days. Like this is the first disaster that is the same. Oh, I was wrong. It's not the same day, but like in this amount of time. No, you know what? I'm not, no spoilies. No spoilies, because I'll probably.
No spoilies. You heard it here first, folks.
Spoilies.
Bad shit's happening, and it's all starting in 1919, and that's all you're going to hear until probably next week.
But yeah, Gary Crist writes of the Wingfoot disaster in this book. He writes, quote, "No one could quite take in the reality of what had happened. How had this experimental blimp, this enormous floating firebomb, been allowed to fly over one of the most densely populated square miles on Earth?" And I just feel like that very precisely.
Well, shit, when you put it that way.
Yeah, like that is how much shit is, that is how Chicago be popping off.
Pop off, sis.
Popping off. But yeah. I highly recommend City of Scoundrels. The audiobook is narrated by Rob Shapiro. He does a great job. And if you thought it was stressful listening to me tell this story, the prose in which it is captured in City of Scoundrels is, oh, it hurts. It's
Can't
so
wait.
Good, but it's like, your
my heart is racing.
Your heart is racing. Your anus is clenched, and that's how. That's how we like you going into a new season of Shared History.
Natalie, I want you to know that I recently got a fake Apple Watch. Because I wanted some sort of sporty computery watch, but I'm really not that sporty or computery, and I'm not spending $300 on it. So I got like a $40 Amazon watch, and it gives me all that fun info that an Apple Watch does, and it's got this fun little stress meter on it. And I'm not gonna say that my stress like skyrocketed, but there is a marked difference from when you and I started speaking and where my stress started at to where it is now.
Cat,
So
you have unlocked a new goal for me doing this podcast.
I'll make sure I'm wearing this every time we record. Thank you, Natalie, for that horrible and horrifying, wonderful topic. And I would love to thank you for mentioning race riots,
Great. I
'cause
will keep my butthole clenched.
only going up from here. Let's see where my stress is at now. And you know, I don't have a rage meter on here because whatever that's at, it's about to spike. Strap in, folks.
No.
Season 7, episode 1. We're starting off strong. No, but let's start off with something a little fun. Natalie, do you know what a zoot suit is?
Oh, I do. I do know what a zoot
Tell
suit is.
me what a zoot suit is.
A zoot suit is a suit that you must wear when you riot. That's why. Zoot suit riots. It's like, think of your classic Guys and Dolls gangster suit with the high waist and like a pretty big blazer, probably a long coat, like big thick lapels. That's a zoot suit.
Yeah, that's a zoot suit. I think of a lot of like wolf animation in like the 40s. I don't
Yeah.
know. I feel like there's
Oh
always like
yeah,
some sort
wolves
of
were always
they're always wearing a zoot suit and then they were whistling and then, you know, when their eyes would pop out and their tongue would roll out, like, yeah.
wolves famously zoot suit wearers.
Actually, if you just Google wolf zoot suit cartoon, that's literally what I think of when I think of a zoot suit. But I'm here to tell you about the zoot suit riots.
Oh wow, great. Because if you
You literally hit the zoot on the head. But we gotta talk about the origins of the zoot suit. So the zoot suit, it was kind of this big, baggy kind of it was like a reverse triangle on the top. You know, it was very like square shoulders, angled into your waist, and then very big, you know, kind of loose waist and thighs, and then kind of angled and tapered down. And you was just fly. You was wearing maybe like a pork pie hat or a fedora, big old feather. Like, he's just looking good. He's just looking fresh. And a lot of hepcats was
Ooh.
another word that I just learned for hipsters. Not hipsters like, I listened to Death Cab for Cutie before you did. But like the OG hipsters of like, you know, we're snapping in our black turtlenecks at an underground Greenwich Village poetry reading. You know, we're in the 1930s and the 1940s kind of hipsters.
Yes.
Artists, Harlem Renaissance, a lot of jazz and blues musicians. This style came from a lot of those jazz and blues clubs, and it was primarily Black Americans, and they were in these clubs and they were dancing, and it was about jazz and music and art and flash and just like looking creme de la creme, being awesome, trendsetters, style setters.
For sure.
Looked dope. All
These
right.
are also usually like patterned or like bold colors.
Yes, very bright, a lot of like yellows and purples and checkers. It was very flashy. It was very much about like style and looking cool. And the reason for these big billowy suits was because they were going to clubs and dance halls and stuff. So all of these new kind of flashy dance moves were coming out where you're moving a lot more of your body. Think of kind of like the 1920s, like the Charleston dances and how women's hemlines were going up so they could be kicking and showing their legs off. As that evolved, men's suits started to get baggier and baggier because they was like cutting a rug and tearing it up.
Have you ever worn like a dress with like a frilly skirt that you just kind of have to twirl? Like, because it just, it's the way that it's draped, is that it's draped to move, and that the zoot suit.
Conversely, have you ever tried to twerk in a mermaid tail dress? It doesn't work. No, you can't twerk with no space. I know this. I didn't think I could twerk for so long because I always wore skinny jeans, and I really just needed to let things loosen up down there. You gotta
let things move.
Let it move. So the zoot suit was it truly was designed functionally to let your body move around so you could be doing all these like crazy kicks and spins and all these cool moves. And I'm so glad we're recording this videoly because Natalie just laughed at me and she's, I'm sure, looking at a timestamp that she's gonna.
So much arm work happening.
Yeah. You should see my legs. But it's, it cuts me off at the waist. So I'm guessing some of this will end up on our Instagram. Check out
at
Shared History Pod. at Shared Pod. So the history of the Zoot Suit Riots goes back to the literal suit. And the suit was created because of jazz and blues and this explosion of the Harlem Renaissance and arts and creativity and joy and music, all of these like amazing things. And it just goes back to what we've always known in the history of the United States is that Black Americans have influenced style and culture and art and music and dance and what have you. So
it also sounds like it's about to go back to another thing we know very well from American history, which is that historically speaking, we don't handle Black joy well.
No. Oh my God, Natalie, how did you know we were about to turn to that? I do just have to say this because we are on the eve of post-Grammys, which when this comes out, this will have been a few months away, but Harry Styles just won Album of the Year. You know, I want great things for Harry Styles, but I think we all know that maybe Beyoncé should have won for Renaissance.
Maybe.
And you know what? And God bless fucking Beyoncé because she accepted her award for best electro pop song, and she thanked the queer community for inventing the genre.
Yeah,
know your roots, and she does. Queer people invented electro pop, and Black people created everything else. And it was Black queer people that created electro pop. So let's just get all that out there. Happy Black History Month! It's February when we are recording this. Just need everyone to know Black people created all the cool shit in America. Let's just give them the credit they deserve. Anyway,
I have a feeling you're not gonna get less angry as this goes on.
Let me check my stress meter here. Nope.
The only way out is up.
So Harlem Renaissance, obviously Harlem, New York, on the East Coast. The zoot suit, the jazz phenomenon, this spread throughout the United States. And now we're over here on the West Coast and we are in Los Angeles in the 1940s now. Okay. So a little bit of history of Los Angeles and the Mexican American community on the West Coast. California was part of Spain for a very long time after Spain colonized Mexico, Central America, South America, a lot of that. California was Spain. Like this is Spain on North America. And then, you know, history happened and wars happened and California became part of Mexico as it seceded from Spain, and then it became part of the United States. So the history of Western America and its Latinx roots are rooted in colonialism with Spain and Mexico. So in the 1940s, the largest population of ethnic Mexicans outside of Mexico was Los Angeles. So this was a very, it was Latin American, but it was primarily Mexican. And as the United States expanded westward and as California and the West started exploding and building up, there was a lot of tension between white Americans and Mexicans who had lived there for generations, but then were like, oh no, this is America now. So even though you've been living here, you're immigrants. And also just the fact of it just being a large Latino population to begin with. So we've got a lot of racial tension there to begin with. So you spread this jazz, blues, quote unquote, black music. And if it's from black people at this time, when America is so accepting, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. And zoot suits became a style. It became a lifestyle. And so these Mexican Americans on the West Coast developed a counterculture, a subculture called Pachuco. And they wore these zoot suits. They were all about looking flashy, about looking fly, about celebrating their culture, about enjoying what they're wearing, about celebrating music and all of these things. It was like that, you know, Natalie saying, we really love celebrating black joy as white Americans. And by really love, I mean, are historically very bad at it. And it's not just black joy. It's any sort of minority joy we don't love. So as California was expanding and as more white people were expanding in those areas, in Los Angeles, there was this area called the Chavez Ravine. And it was kind of this, it was this L-shaped ravine in like a canyon just outside of LA. And it was an agricultural area. A lot of Mexican and Mexican American people lived there. So in the late 30s and early 40s, the racial tension that happened in LA had to do with poor city planning. It was very spread out awkwardly. And then as well as they're trying to expand, they're moving around like resource areas and people who live right here, but we need to be around that area, or we're building things in the middle of nowhere. So there was just a lot of poor city planning that contributed to a lot of civil unrest. The Naval Reserve Armory, which was a naval training school, decided to plant down right in the middle of the Chavez Ravine. Again, it's a working class immigrant area. This is when there was a lot of tension between white Americans and the Latinx community. In 1942, there had been, they weren't riots yet, but there was a lot of tension. There was this huge murder trial about this man, Jose Diaz, and he was killed by members of the 38th Street Gang. And this was in the Sleepy Lagoon murder case. So it was just this, it was this gang rivalry thing. The members of this gang had killed this man named Jose Diaz, and it became this huge kind of like blockbuster trial that everyone was kind of obsessing over. Mm-hmm. And in the wake of this, we're also in the midst of World War II, now people in LA, white people in LA, have this hot button issue, and they're starting to target members of the Latinx community, saying, oh, they're all gang members. Now you bring over this jazz, zoot suit style era. Now this culture clash of jazz and zoot suits are coming together, and we've already got some unrest with the Latinx community here, and now this jazz music and these crazy kids with all the music and the flashy dancing are coming in, and the pachuco subculture of Mexican Americans at this time was blowing up. So in the midst of World War II, when there are all of these rations going on, we're rationing food, we're rationing tin, we're rationing clothing, they use zoot suits as an excuse to say that Mexican Americans were being disrespectful towards servicemen and women, that they were using way too much fabric in their clothing. So that means that they didn't support military, which means they were anti-war.
My eyes just rolled into
that. Yeah, we're doing some mental gymnastics here. Yes. And it's interesting because the number of not just Mexican, but Latino service members in World War II is exorbitant. The numbers are so high. There were so many Latin American and Latino service members in the United States Army, in the Navy, during World War II. But we latched onto this thing. Oh, jazz, right? Jazz is always a dirty word, right? They're probably smoking the marijuana.
It was jazz cigarettes.
And it's associated with Black Americans. And anything associated with Black Americans at the time, not now, we've totally moved past that.
Sure.
Is bad, right? We can't trust them. And the Latino population in the West was similar to the Black population in the East, right? There were much more Latinos in the West than there were Black Americans. There were much more Black Americans in the East than there were Latinos. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like same story, different side of the country.
Pick your racism.
So with this murder trial that had gone on the year before, with growing racial tension in the United States in general, rations, also prior to World War II, during the Great Depression, like I said, California used to be Spain, and then it was Mexico, and then it was America, right? So these people had lived there, and they just kept getting recolonized. In the Great Depression, so in the early 30s, 500,000, it was either 500,000 or 500 million, large number of Mexicans were illegally deported from California because of lack of resources, right? And we wanted those resources to go to white Americans as opposed to Mexicans. They weren't really Americans. They were Mexicans, even though they've been there forever. So they illegally deported 500,000 or million Mexicans from the area because it's a Great Depression. We don't have resources. We're not giving them to you. So we've already had this precedent set as Mexicans taking resources from Americans in the Great Depression. Cool. Now we're in World War II. Ooh, Mexicans, we know they like to take resources from Americans, and now they're wearing suits with a lot of fabric. They hate America. They don't support us in the war. Let's go fight them. The good thing, though, after the Zoot Suit Riots, we've never blamed Mexicans for taking resources.
Never.
Ever again.
Never.
Never. Never been a thing. So, like I said, this Naval Reserve Training Center was put in the Chavez Reserve area, which was right in the middle of L.A., right in the middle of working class immigrant families in L.A. So, in 1943, between June 3rd and June 8th, American servicemen from this Naval Academy targeted Mexican Americans. They're just kind of, everything had built up, and they thought of them as draft dodgers, and they thought of them as kind of resource hoarders. Like, you're just throwing it in our face that you're using all of this fabric.
Greedy and lazy.
150 plus people, Mexican Americans, were injured. 500 plus were arrested. It started with the servicemen attacking them. They were just pouring through the street with bats. They were beating them. And then there were police officers there watching, not stopping anything. And then after these Zoot Suiters would get beaten and bloodied, then they'd throw them in their paddy wagons. And then white people just observing would start joining in on it too. So just random men and women civilians. Not only would they just randomly start beating these people, they stripped them. They would rip their clothes off. And there are pictures of Mexican Americans sitting in their underwear, bloody in the middle of the street, which is not only, you know, they're hurt, they're injured, it's degrading, it's vengeful. It's just, you're just trying to humiliate them.
Yeah, it's dehumanizing.
And it was, ugh. Sorry. I'm checking my rage meter and it is high. So that's the Zoot Suit Riots.
What a time.
What a time.
What a, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I had never heard of that. I heard of the Zoot Suit Riots on some random, like, listicle thing. Maybe it was a JSTOR thing. And it made me think of, like, one your episode on, like, the Flirt Club, Anti-Flirt Club Society or something. I was like, oh, this sounds goofy and quaint.
Oh, yeah. No. Really goofy and quaint and so deserving of a jitterbuggin'
yeah.
tune by the Cherry Poppin' Dandy Poppin' Cherry Poppin' Daddies.
Yeah.
Which is a phrase I don't want to ever say. Cherry Poppin'.
Yeah, I don't want to hear it ever again.
I don't
again
like
either.
It. I'm upset about.
No, but it was something I'd never heard of, and obviously everyone knows, like, the makeup of the Western United States is, like, that's where primarily and historically the Latinx population has existed in the United States. And migration and immigration, everything has spread that. But it was interesting in this time of, like, the Great Depression, we think of the coasts, right? The middle is just, like, farmers. It's just homogenous, white, like, you just exist there.
Yeah.
And all of the diversity is on the coasts, which is, I mean, kind of how diversity and integration works, right? It's hard to get into the middle of a country sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really interesting getting more context on the Latinx population in the West and where all of these modern day stereotypes, fear-mongering ideas come from, you know, like, this used to be Spain, right? And then it was Mexico, and then it was the United States, and then, oh, we're running out of resources, we're gonna push you out, and we're now gonna use that as a precedent for the rest of our political agenda for the next 200 plus years for any time we need a scapegoat.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's the receipts are all there, and it's just a matter of auditing them.
This episode brought to you by unnecessary explosions of very some.
Hey, jazz was a much needed explosion.
That's fair. Some are a chemical reaction. And some are the reaction of, and some are a white reaction.
I was just going to say, it's a white reaction.
Yeah.
Season 7, baby.
We have
baby.
A fun season for you. I feel like we did this last season, too. We started, like, with just an episode that had both of us going,
Natalie asked me before we started, she goes, what is, I thought she was going to ask like a timeline.
Yeah.
She goes, what's like the vibe? Like, is it an upper or a downer? And I was like, oh yeah, mine's a downer. And she's like, oh good, mine too. So like, I guess it doesn't matter who's going to go first or second. And like yours is a disaster and I feel horrible, but I hate to say it's not a silly disaster, but blimps are just kind of goofy.
And yeah, hairy. And yours is very much a like man-made disaster.
Yeah.
Yours is a downer. Mine went up, and what goes up must come down.
That's just happens. Science.
That's just science. We're not scientists.
No, we are not scientists. We're not historians either.
I don't know. After 97 episodes, we might be.
Honestly, yeah. When do we get our 10,000 hours?
We're probably getting there. Counting editing, we're probably getting there.
Oh, fuck. We're definitely there. Natalie, just to pull us away from the sadness.
Sure.
Have you discovered anything since last we've met?
I'm sure that I've discovered a great many things. As we were discussing before we started recording, I asked Cass to ask me about my mental health. And when she did, I responded with just the amount of books that I've already read to date. And it is the first week of February, and I read damn near 30 books.
I immediately bought Natalie a life alert.
What I need is if it's life alert, but when I press it, somebody storms into my bedroom, slaps my Kindle out of my hand, and then slaps me until I fall asleep. That's the service that I require during
I would do these that trying for you. Times. If I could apparate, I would do that for you.
I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I have a the discovery that comes to mind is a very recent etymological discovery, courtesy of one of my castmates for Baby Wants Candy. Who this is indicative of what people assume that I'm interested in, the fact that it's etymology and Scottish. Did you know that the word glamour comes from Scots?
No.
It
does. I mean, I didn't know it either way, but I was trying to think if I could have guessed it. But I couldn't have. Explain.
Okay, I will. In the early 1700s, the Scottish altered the word grammar to glamour or glamour. And when I like glamour spelled G-L-A-M-E-R or glamour, G-L-A-M-O-U-R, meaning a magic spell. And the reason was, if I'm recalling this correctly, the reason is that it was mostly the fact that grammar at the time kind of had like a weird mystical quality to it, where it just was like grammar and like grammatica, the Latin grammatica at the time was included not just what we think of grammar now, but just like learning in general. Mm. And since learning was couched in a language that was not, that like learning was couched in Latin, like you learned Latin. That's what, if you went to school and you were an academic in the 1700s, you learned in Latin, and that was a language that was not spoken or understood by the plebs, by the unschooled masses. And so it was commonly believed that like subjects like magic and astrology and whatnot, and were included in Latin grammatica and Latin learning, and just it was just like the way that the Scots used the word and the way that it sounded when their accent skewed towards glamour, one, I think. And then also just like we thought that smart people were wizards was the other.
Wait, so it was almost a bastardization of grammar?
Yes.
So glamour? Glamour.
Exactly. The word glamour comes from grammar because we just
smart people are glamorous.
Thought that people were who were smart knew magic because we didn't understand all of like we didn't understand what language they were speaking. It was Latin. And we
it's like if you don't know, if I don't know something and you know it, you're a wizard, Harry.
Exactly. So that's the thing that I, Nathan on Baby Wants Candy told me backstage this week.
That's amazing.
And I don't know if people, I guess like there's also the side, if you don't read, if you haven't read like King Arthur and you don't know like the story of Merlin, and if you're not reading, if you don't read fantasy, you might not think of the word glamour in the sense of like the magic glamour.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I'm not talking about like Beyonce at the Grammys is glamorous. I'm talking
right. It was like mysticism almost.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So I am taking an adolescent lit class as part of getting my teaching license. And like, I didn't read a lot of adolescent literature. And they're talking about how it's being integrated into actual history now, like into like middle school history. They're like YA authors are writing books for like social studies teachers to use. And I just heard about this book called Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge by Erica Armstrong Dunbar. And I just found out that George Washington, the inventor of freedom, one of his slaves ran away and he spent like years and years and years trying to get this slave back. And she like thwarted that. And I don't know the whole story, but I just found out about it. And I'm getting this book and reading it because it sounds phenomenal. And it's being integrated into a lot of like middle school history classes and lessons to kind of talk about the history that we don't talk about and giving that perspective. So slavery and Black Americans' history is not just kind of a niche topic or a little side note. It's let's tell you about this founding father and his accomplishments. At the same time, he spent so much of his time dealing with this horrible slavery issue, his entire career. Fun discoveries.
It's a shame that you and I very much don't care for little known history.
I know. This podcast would be so much funner if it weren't.
Yeah. It's just not for us. Listeners, if you want to find our sources, if you want to find some more visual aids and the like, you can find those over at sharedhistorypodcast.com. We're also on the Instagrams at sharedpod. We are currently still on the Twitter, but I'm not using it that much because fuck that guy at sharedpod. But we are on Mastodon. We are on the history. What are they called? We're on a history server, the Histodon server on Mastodon, and we are at Shared History Pod over there. You can find us there.
You can find us on Patreon.
It's patreon.com/broadsheetradio. The link is in the doobly-doo, along with the visual aids, the aforementioned visual aids.
You guys, we're so excited to be back for season 7. It's going to be fun. It's going to be fiery. It's going to be stressful. There's going to be a lot of Chicago.
Yes. It's going to be deep. It's going to be deep dish. Can't wait to yell about pizza. Oh, I'm for sure going to yell about pizza on this episode, on this season. I guarantee it.
You know, Natalie, we just got a Giordano's in Des Moines. Deep dish pizza is perhaps Chicago pizza. We each order some deep dish and we dish deep on history together.
We're 100% that's going to happen. It's 100% going to happen. It's going to happen. If you're like, wow, Natalie talks about Chicago a lot, I wish she would talk about it more. Our Patreon bonus episodes often feature little locals, and our little locals often feature me telling you the history of a park or a landmark in Chicago, or for Cass, Des Moines or Iowa at large. So go support us on Patreon for access to all those goodies. Until next time, friends.
Share you later.
Broadsheet Radio Network.